Back with you on a Thursday, February 16th, 2023 edition of Connecticut Today. We started the show off with an update live from President Biden on the recent shootdowns of flying objects traversing the U.S. Quinnipiac University professor Mark Geis discussed the overall effectiveness of gun control laws across the U.S. And State Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly of Stratford updated his party's proposals to try and lower health care costs.
I gave the order to take down these three objects due to hazards to civilian commercial air traffic and because we could not rule out the surveillance risk of sensitive facilities. We acted in consultation with the Canadian government. I spoke personally with Prime Minister Trudeau and from Canada on Saturday. And just as critically, we acted out of an abundance of caution and an opportunity that allowed us to take down these objects safely. Our military and the Canadian military are seeking to recover the debris so we can learn more about these three objects. Our intelligence community is still assessing all three incidences. They're reporting to me daily and will continue their urgent efforts to do so, and I will communicate that to the Congress. We don't yet know exactly what these three objects were, but nothing right now suggests they were related to China's spy balloon program or that they were surveillance vehicles from any other country. The intelligence community's current assessment is that these three objects were most likely balloons tied to private companies, recreation or research institutions studying weather or conducting other scientific research. When I came into office, I instructed our intelligence community to take a broad look at the phenomenon of unidentified aerial objects. We know that a range of entities, including countries, companies, and research organizations, operate objects at altitudes for purposes that are not nefarious, including legitimate scientific research. I want to be clear. We don't have any evidence that there has been a sudden increase in the number of objects in the sky. We're now just seeing more of them, partially because the steps we've taken to increase our radars, to narrow our radars. And we have to keep adapting our approach to dealing with these challenges. That's why I've directed my team to come back to me with sharper rules for how we will deal with these unidentified objects moving forward, distinguishing between those that are likely to pose safety and security risks that necessitate action and those that do not. But make no mistake, if any object presents a threat to the safety and security of the American people, I will take it down. I'll be sharing with Congress these classified policy parameters when they are completed, and they'll remain classified so we don't give our roadmap to our enemies to try to evade our defenses. Going forward, these parameters will guide what actions we'll take while responding to unmanned and unidentified aerial objects. We're going to keep adapting them as the challenges evolve, if it evolves. In addition, I've directed my national security advisor to lead a government-wide effort to make sure we are positioned to deal safely and effectively with the objects in our airspace. First, we will establish a better inventory of unmanned airborne objects in space above the United States airspace and make sure that inventory is accessible and up to date. Second, we'll implement further measures to improve our capacity to detect unmanned objects in our airspace. Third, we'll update the rules and regulations for launching and maintaining unmanned objects in the skies above the United States of America. And fourth, my Secretary of State will lead an effort to help establish common global norms in this largely unregulated space. These steps will lead to safer and more secure skies for our air travelers, our military, our scientists, and for people on the ground as well. That's my job as your president, commander-in-chief. As the events of the previous days have shown, we'll always act to protect the interest of the American people and the security of the American people. Since I came to office, we've developed the ability to identify, track, and study high-altitude surveillance balloons connected with the Chinese military. When one of these high-altitude surveillance balloons entered our airspace over the continental United States earlier in the month, I gave the order to shoot it down as soon as it would be safe to do so. The military advised against shooting it down over land because of the sheer size of it. It was the size of multiple school buses and posed a risk to people on the ground if it was shot down where people lived. Instead, we tracked it closely. We analyze its capabilities, and we learn more about how it operates. And because we knew its path, we were able to protect sensitive sites against collection. We waited until it was safely over water, which would not only protect civilians, but also enable us to recover substantial components for further analytics. And then we shot it down, sending a clear message. The violation of our sovereignty is unacceptable. We'll act to protect our country, and we did. Now, this past Friday, we put restrictions on six firms that directly support the People's Republic Liberation Army, the People's Liberation Army Aerospace Program, that includes airships and balloons, denying them access to U.S. technology. We briefed our diplomatic partners and our allies around the world, and we know about China's program and where their balloons have flown. Some of them have also raised their concerns directly with China. Our exports have lifted components of the Chinese balloon's payload off the ocean floor. We're analyzing them as I speak, and what we learn will strengthen our capabilities. Now, we'll also continue to engage with China, as we have throughout the past 2 weeks. As I've said since the beginning of my administration, we seek competition, not conflict with China. We're not looking for a new Cold War, but I make no apologies, and we will compete. And we'll responsibly manage that competition so that it doesn't veer into conflict. This episode underscores the importance of maintaining open lines of communication between our diplomats and our military professionals. Our diplomats will be engaging further, and I will remain in communication with President Xi. I'm grateful for the work of the last several weeks of our intelligence, diplomatic, and military professionals who have proved once again to be the most capable in the world. And I want to thank you all. Now, look, the other thing I want to point out is that we are going to keep our allies and the Congress contemporaneously informed of all we know and all we learn. And I expect to be speaking with President Xi, and I hope we're going to get to the bottom of this. But I make no apologies for taking down that balloon. Thank you very much.
Shifting gears, of course, we've saw over the past few days more shootings, an individual at a Michigan college, and then we had another mall or commercial place shooting in the past couple of days. Do any of these gun laws, and it's almost reflexive now, well, we need more laws and more laws, but do any of these really work? What about new laws? What about an analysis of what's going on in places that have layers and layers of gun laws? Professor Mark Geis joins us. He's a professor of economics at Quinnipiac, and he studies gun control, crime, and public policy. His thoughts and opinions and studies have been cited by various media outlets, including the Washington Post and the Associated Press. Professor Geis, hi. It's Paul again at WICC. How are you?
Very good, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. Give us kind of the macro view on this, Professor, before the micro view. Indicators that any of these gun laws, from the assault weapons ban and the major laws down to taxes on ammunition, different laws regarding ammo clips, do any of these work? Do we know? How do we measure all that? Where do we stand right now?
Well, first of all, mass shootings, depending on how you define it, are actually pretty rare.
Mm-hmm.
Although some people have said that there's been increase in frequency, it's really how you define it. And the government's definition, and the one I use a lot is, or use all the time, is four individuals who are killed, not counting the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it also could not be connected to any crime. So, for example, if somebody killed four people in a bank robbery, technically that's not a mass shooting. That's a bank robbery gone bad. So they're actually much rarer than you think. And most of the gun laws, unfortunately, don't affect these types of crimes because most mass shooters are very methodical. They plan these events out, these incidents out, maybe weeks, months ahead of time. Many of them have no criminal or mental health history, or at least documented mental health history. So essentially, they're flying under the wire. Nobody even knows they're there. As I said, they very rarely do have any type of criminal or violent criminal behavior. So it's very hard. It's a very random event. In my research, I found the only gun control law that had a somewhat effect, somewhat of an effect on mass shooting deaths was the assault weapons ban. And primarily I expected that kind of just because assault weapons are used much more frequently in mass shootings than they are in your garden variety murder. The vast majority of firearm murders are committed by handguns in the United States. In fact, fewer than 1,000 murders a year are committed using rifles, which is an assault weapon, while last year there were over 20,000 handgun murders or firearm murders. So it's a pretty small percentage. But unfortunately, it's just we're looking at kind of, I would like to say, the wrong piece of the puzzle because it's not the mass shootings because they actually are just a small part of the overall firearm homicides, which is rather large.
And you are correct, and I have felt that in my own family. Professor Geis, I had a relative who was killed. It was a workplace shooting, you could say, and it was not done with a long gun, with a rifle, with an AR-15, with a shotgun. It was done with your garden variety small caliber handgun. But the perception, though, Professor Geis, and we're talking to Professor Mark Geis from Quinnipiac, the perception is, or we've all heard the phrase, you know, perception is reality. And the reality, Dr. Geis, Professor Geis, to a lot of people is, oh, it's all those long guns. And that must be, as a researcher and as somebody who looks into it like you do, that must be frustrating to a point.
Yeah, it is. I mean, only assault weapons, once again, depending on how you measure mass shootings, they're involved in maybe about 30 to 40% of mass shootings. All the rest, the thing is with mass shooters, they typically come with multiple firearms, just like the mass shooter did in Michigan State. He had two handguns. So they typically come with multiple firearms. And so it is kind of frustrating, but it's the perception that's given off. And usually, too, the mass shootings that involve assault weapons or long guns are typically the ones that have higher victim counts. Think of the Las Vegas shooting or Sandy Hook, Uvalde. Those are the ones really that have, and typically because if you have an assault weapon, you're firing a much more powerful round than if you have a handgun.
And Professor, listen, when you come right down to it, I think you and I would agree on this. I think a lot of people do around the country. The act of pulling a mass shooting or executing some sort of shooting, as you say, that is not involved in another crime, a jewelry robbery, a bank robbery, a carjacking, that in and of itself is not the act of a mentally sane individual. So I guess you could say, and correct me if I'm wrong, you could say that every one of these mass shootings without any sort of purpose might be attributable to, as some people like to argue, not the gun, but the person holding the gun.
Well, it is, yes, to a certain extent. The problem is a lot of these individuals, if they do have mental health issues, they've been totally misdiagnosed or undiagnosed for years and years. And nobody really knows, because technically speaking, if you have a history of mental health illness, you can't buy a firearm.
Yeah.
But they typically fly under the wire. And a lot of these individuals who engage in mass shootings purchased all of their firearms perfectly legally. It's pretty rare when you find one that hasn't purchased it legally. but that's the biggest issue, really. And I'm not a mental health expert by any stretch of the imagination. But you'd be amazed at the rationale some of these mass shooters come up with for conducting a mass shooting. Plus, in addition, many times the mass shooter kills himself, so we have no idea even why they did it. I mean, that shooter in Vegas, we have no idea why that person did it. And he didn't even fit the profile of a mass shooter, which is typically a young white male who's frustrated, distraught, and a loner. He didn't even fit that.
Yeah, that case that case really has stumped people, right? They're pretty much a dead end on that case, right?
Yes. They don't know why he did it or anything. And you could even say the same thing somewhat about Sandy Hook. That individual had no connection to the elementary school, and yet he went and shot it all up. It's just it's something that even going through his computer background and everything else, it's very hard for them to determine exactly why they picked that certain place and why they did what they did.
Why? Let me ask you this. A lot of these gun laws can be easily, Professor, worked around by gun companies who are selling a product. Okay, I can just make the barrel this much shorter, or I can use a different type of grip, or I can make the magazine smaller, less capacity. So I've gotten around that part of the law. So what about these other things that we hear in other states and other proposals? Well, for example, high taxes on ammunition, different types of registration. Do any of these, you think, have any effect? Do we know, or any of these being implemented or not?
Well, I haven't done any research on taxes on ammunition. I do know, though, that ammunition is rather expensive. I don't know if you've purchased any recently, but it's rather expensive. So, for example, a 223 round, which is used in most assault weapons, that's about $1 to $1.50 a round, which isn't cheap. You know, for and even in the assault rifle itself, I mean, depending on what brand you buy and what extra bells and whistles you get with it, you're looking at anywhere from $1,000 to upwards of $5,000 for one weapon. So it's rather expensive already. And as I said, usually mass shooters are planners. They plan these things for weeks or months ahead of time. And, you know, a lot of times they save up and they spend their money on weapons and ammunition. And in many states, even in Connecticut, there's no law against buying a lot of ammunition. So, you know, I'm not really sure, as economists say, how elastic the demand for ammunition is. So is it really elastic? In other words, if the price of ammunition goes up a lot, people are going to just say, forget it, I'm not going to shoot up that Walmart. Or are they going to say, I don't care if the price doubles or triples, I'm still going to do it. So
I don't think if
somebody is a mass shooter, I really don't think increasing the price of ammunition is going to sway them very much.
Yeah, because I did hear that mentioned. Professor, in about the minute we have left here, one thing, and I always say this, and I, like I said, my family's been touched by this, so I don't say this flippantly, but we have 400 million guns in this country by most estimates. There's more than one gun per person. You know, Professor, from a statistical standpoint, if you step back at this and look at this, you know, with the numbers, I'm shocked this doesn't happen more. I mean, we have 400 million guns in this country. Yeah. That's a shocking number.
No, it is. It is. And probably about around 35 to 40% of U.S. households have guns. So it's not a majority. So most, and believe it or not, a lot of the guns are owned by a smaller percentage of the gun owners, because they own like 20, 30 weapons, you know what I mean? And no, but it is. It's, and a lot of, in a, I liken it to, you know, the horse has already left the barn.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many guns out there that even if you stop producing guns tomorrow, there's 400 million. There's more than enough to, you know, commit any crime or do any mayhem. And in most states, private sales, there are no background checks or anything like that, so anybody could go to another guy and buy a gun, and there's no record of it, and they don't check up on you, and we have no borders between states, so you could just ride from one state to another, and it's happens all the time.
Yeah. Professor Mark Ice, Quinnipiac University. Professor, thank you. We appreciate the time, and we'll check back in the down the road. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Professor Mark Geist there, Quinnipiac University. Senate Republicans today up in Hartford unveiling a plan they say to make health care more affordable. Joining us right now to talk about the bullet points of that and where these solutions, these proposed solutions, were from, Republican State Senate Leader Kevin Kelly joins us again here on the program. Kevin, hey, it's Paul. How are you?
Hey, Paul, I'm doing well. Yourself?
I'm living the dream, Kevin, living the dream every day. As long as all four limbs work when I wake up, it's all good.
It is.
It is. It is. And when you get to my age, little things, Kevin. You unveiled a better way to affordable health care. Give my listeners a few details here. Where are some of these ideas from, Kevin, and what are we looking at as to the prospects of them being passed? What do we have?
Well, Paul, as you know, we always believe that good ideas find friends. And while the Republicans may be in the minority, we've put forward ideas last year, such as a 1% cut in the income tax and the fiscal guardrails, and voila, even though we don't have the numbers, we have fiscal guardrails in place for another 5 years and possibly 5 years after that. And in the governor's budget, there was a 1% cut on income for middle and working class families. So we think these are good ideas, too. And what we're focusing on today was health care, specifically premiums. We have a bill that can reduce premiums by 30%. That's an average savings for a family of four, about $7,000 a year, almost $600 a month. For the past several years, we've been unable to get that out of committee. Obviously, we don't have the numbers. The majority is Democrat. However, once again, I think it's a great idea. When I walked door to door in the last campaign, families told me the cost of health care and their prescriptions and their insurance was off the hook. Well, here's a way that you can reduce it. And $7,000 to the average family, that's real money.
I know, well, Kevin, you had told me in the past, I see a couple of things here that I know we talked about before. Mm-hmm. A couple of things here were called, you've mentioned benchmarking before and also more pool purchasing. Talk about those.
Well, the benchmarking, what it does is it uses best practices of the various medical providers. They disclose what they do. And basically look across, they disclose it to the state, and the state takes that information, looks across the field, and develops best practices and works in collaboration with the providers. And by doing that, it drives down costs. In Massachusetts, where we got this idea from, they were able to reduce costs that were about 10 to 12% increases year over year and drove it down to less than 3.5%. So there was real savings in the billions in Massachusetts, and I think we can do the same thing here in Connecticut to lower the cost of the actual medical service that's provided. What was the other thing you talked about?
The pool purchasing, Kevin. Right. Yeah.
The pool purchasing, that's basically getting a bunch of states, like the New England states, for instance, that would then pull together and buy prescription drugs in bulk and drive the cost down and be able to drive a better price with the pharmaceutical manufacturers. I do know the governor has a proposal that would look at doing the same thing with regards to a Medicare pricing, but it's using the number of states. You know, Connecticut, Rhode Island are smaller states, but if we can join with a New York and a Massachusetts and a New Jersey, we'd have bigger buying power and help to drive down the cost because of the leverage that you'd get by having a bigger pool of prescriptions to purchase.
So, Kevin, you know, the obvious question here from many people I know listening right now is, hey, these all sound like great ideas. Who would be against this? Who do you anticipate pushback from on some of these things that seem to be, at least on the surface, some common sense stuff here?
Well, they are common sense, and a lot of it is misunderstanding. I mean, you could expect a pushback from hospitals. You might get pushback from prescription drug manufacturers. But I think if you look at just these, the way that it's been done with benchmarking and that we're looking at best practices, we're offering carrots, not sticks, and working with them, eliminating middlemen and I'm going to say impediments and letting some market forces and competition work, I think they are good ideas. And we just have to be on the lookout for those who are against them. Become the bigger voice for the middle and working class families and make sure that their voice is heard in this process. And I think once, like I said at the outset, good ideas find friends, and I'm hopeful that this session we will do that.
And finally, Kevin, one thing here that's interesting, and I think you've talked about this before on the show as well, this projected savings long term by using what's called a state-based reinsurance program. Explain that.
Yeah, basically what that does is it would afford that you'd be able to keep your doctor. It keeps the current structure in place, keeps good-paying Connecticut jobs because it does keep insurance and insurers in place.
Mm-hmm.
But because the Affordable Care Act, and our state has made public policies that we like the idea of making sure that people with pre-existing conditions and certain other chronic ailments are covered by insurance and that that doesn't operate against them, that if those are the public policies, then there should be a public, I'm going to say, contribution to the pool so that when you have these costs that exceed the normal risk, there is a reinsurance pool of money there to pay for those resources. As a result, it drives down the cost to the average consumer, and that's where we have the $7,000 to the average family of four in purchasing health insurance. So that's a savings of like $600 a month, and well, that's real money to Connecticut families.
Absolutely. Well, Kevin, good luck. Keep us informed as to how any or all of these are doing. Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it.
You bet. Take care, Paul.
All right, there you go. So there you go, folks. Some ideas there. Implementing a state-based reinsurance program, addressing prescription drug affordability by bulk purchasing. A lot of stuff here. Subject hospitals to the same cost growth benchmarking requirements as insurance companies are. So we'll see. Again, there's always, you know, these ideas sound really good. But there will always be pushback, particularly here in the state, that face it. Let's face it. We have a state that's got some major medical centers here who are looking out for, you know, some of their own interests and big insurance companies as well. So thanks to Kevin Kelly.